Yeah, I was going to ask, we're not doing a Ridley Scott series, are we?
No. What we're doing is we're doing a Ridley Scott series, which is where we cash in on Gladiator 24 years after its release. Yeah.
Amazing. Let's start the show.
Let's go, buddy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Every Movie Ever podcast. My name is Ben Groves.
My name is Robert McFarlane, and welcome to the show, a movie podcast / mental health check-in for two broken brain best friends talking around their problems, but not about their problems.
Never about
whilst,
them.
You know, laughing at movies. So before I get to what we're doing this week, Ben,
yeah,
got to do the more important question.
Go for it.
How are you doing this week?
I'm doing good, man.
Yeah?
I'm a little bit sleepy. My mentals aren't too heavy at the moment, which is nice.
You've not got heavy mentals?
I've not got the heavy mentals. I'm on the light shoegazy mentals at the
okay,
moment.
Okay, nice. You're on the folk mentals.
Yeah. How about you?
Oh, mate, I've got the heaviest mental.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm a bit gloomy.
Ooh.
So I'm just going to talk about a movie, and we're going to talk about one of my favourite movies of all time, and it's hopefully going to make me feel better.
Good. What we're doing today, buddy, like I've just said, we're cashing in.
Yeah.
On 2000's Gladiator,
mate. Cashing out.
Epic sword and sandal revenge story. Gladiator.
I love this film.
Yeah.
Just quickly before we do, Ben, I want to point out, not everyone likes everything, right?
I agree.
Marmite.
Coldplay.
Pegging.
Love a pineapple on pizza.
That's right. So if you, dear listener, hear us cry pineapple,
yes,
it's just a short bit of the chat that might not be to everyone's taste and is less about the film than a brand new listener might need. But not to worry, the full spicy Hawaiian version of every episode is available over on Patreon days beforehand with all the pineapple you could ever want for just £1 a month. Likewise, our potty mouths are going to be censored in this version of the episode, but you can hear all the bad words you like on Patreon.
Like...
Yes. Like...
Hey, lovely.
We've got a lot to get into this week, so let's put the pineapple behind us for right now.
Yeah.
And talk about what we're going to be getting into this week, Ben. Let's give them the menu.
We're going to be getting into why Ridley Scott decided to make this film.
How this script evolved from thin pitch to still quite thin final draft.
Very thin. Are tigers good co-stars?
How the sets of Gladiator gave us the Rome we deserved.
Hell yes, buddy. Now listen, I've gone a little bit over the board with the research on this because I know it's your favourite film.
Yeah, and it's weird because we kind of alternate weeks, right? Like one of us will pick a film and we'll kind of guide the other one to it.
Sure.
But this is your week and we're doing Gladiator and you sat me down and you're like, babe, I've got this. So I'm just going to be told facts like about my film that...
Yeah, because you started going, yeah, I'm going to do this. I was like, fuck off.
Right, yeah. That was right? The closest to
this is my week.
Yeah.
You sit down.
Sit down, you
up.
Saucy f***ing tart. If I knew a shit out of you, I'll pull your flash, you f***ing toilet.
Brilliant. So swear jars at 9 already. That's fantastic. But I've gone over the top with research. Yeah. It's not all going to get in the episode because, I don't know, hyper-focus.
Yeah.
I've gone every direction possible just in case it comes
kicking
up.
Kicking it like the old days.
Right? Because I know exactly which way this is going.
Yeah.
So, with Gladiator 2 rapidly approaching, we need to prepare ourselves for Ridley Scott to yet again ruin another one of his own universes. We're getting into this, right? I'm going to set the scene for us.
Right,
you ready?
Okay.
I'm going to set the scene. The year 2000, Rob. Right. I need you to come back with me to the year 2000.
Not much has changed, but we live underwater.
get out. Was that a busted reference?
I don't know, Ben. Your brain made it, not me.
Was that a busted reference? Answer me right now. I don't know the lyrics to it, but it sounded poppy. I hate... right, we're having words.
Your great-great-granddaughter.
Get in the bin.
She's pretty fine.
The year 2000. Ooh. Nintendo have just announced GameCube, and I'm guessing that in response to that, the European Union announces the Euro. One coin to rule them all. Am I right, Lord of the Rings fans? Am I right, Peter Jackson? I think I am.
Ben, this is
much
this
like
is why we write these together.
Yeah, I haven't written this one down. You can't veto this. Much like Brad and Angelina, The Twin Towers are going stronger than ever. Not a worry in sight.
For God's sakes.
The first British women reached the South Pole.
Really?
There's a frigid joke in there, but I'm not going to... I'm not going to go there. It's fine. It's fine. There's a joke there. We're not. We're both big enough to not make it, all right?
Yeah, I'm glad.
Kevin Spacey's film, American Beauty, wins a shitload of awards in 2000. Ooh, that's a good
that's
one.
That's not aged well, is it?
Yeah, that's a good one, that one, buddy. Mm. Oh, and Ridley Scott is given $103 million to make Gladiator.
You're a big fan of Swords and Sandals, aren't you, Ben? You're like a big...
No!
You love this genre. History.
I know two films in this genre. It's a period piece and it's sandals. Yeah. I dislike both of those. But I know two films in this category. Caligula.
I don't know that one.
Yes, you do.
Caligula.
Caligula.
Oh, Caligula. Sorry.
Caligula.
Your internet dropped for a second and it was like, Caligula. And I was like, if this is some f***ing movie about a haunted scuba suit.
Amazing. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Just a ghost that hunts fish.
Right. That's literally, Ben, you brought weirder films and been like, oh, well, you know, it's like that classic 1970s exploitation movie, Lamp.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, because now you don't know whether it's British exploitation and it's just domestic violence or whether it's a physical lamp and the intrigue kills you. You've got to watch it.
For our US based listeners, to lamp someone in the face is to punch them.
Oh, yeah. To punch.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's just a word. It's a slang word that exists a bit like yeet or riz.
British people just lamp the English language until it submits, you know what I mean?
Yeah, this was kind of like the first Swords and Sandals film for a very long time. This was like somebody going, I'm going to spend $100 million on a black and white musical.
Yeah.
And someone going, yeah, great, I'll give you that.
Sound. All right, yeah, wicked. Is the script really strong?
Okay, so you're not a Swords and Sandals guy, so...
I'm not.
You didn't watch this when it came out?
I watched it when I was younger. I didn't watch it when it came out.
Right.
It's one of those films that people have always told me is amazing. Like, mind-changingly good. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure it is, you know. Mm-hmm. It's Russell Crowe in a leather skirt and a sword running around, right? Yeah, oh, but Tiger, cool, fantastic.
What a way to sum up this film.
In my mind, in my very immature mind, that's all I ever saw.
Holdovers, mate. It's just a cross-eyed guy looking after a kid, isn't it?
Oh, what? I wonder how this story is going to end. Right. Oh, wait, it ended 2,000 years ago. Obviously, obviously the end is pretty clear, right? What mystery are we going to unsolve in this one?
I love the idea that you watch Passion of the Christ being like, well, know how this one ends.
That's exactly what I did when I watched that film. I was like, "There's no, oh yeah, I wonder where this is going." You know what I mean? There's none of that.
Right, okay,
you know exactly where it's going. It's just how racist is Mel Gibson?
So this wasn't your thing.
Not for me. You did you watch this when it came out?
I was 11 in the year 2000, going to be turning 12.
Yeah,
I was just at the age where I could start going to see stuff at the cinema that wasn't like kids' films.
Right.
So I got snuck in to see the first Matrix movie.
Right. No, Jesus Christ. Yeah,
and
sure.
And I got snuck in to see this. And it was mint. It was one of my first adult films at the cinema. I think this is one of the films that set the template for what I think a blockbuster should be.
Okay.
I know contemporary blockbusters are like Fast and the Furious, Marvel movies, Transformers, right? Where it's like, it's a spectacle and it's incredibly easily digested.
And you were like, I want more dust.
I want more depth. You can enjoy this film as just spectacle. You certainly could in the year 2000.
Oh yeah,
1000%. Less so now, but in the year 2000, this was insane.
Yeah.
And you could do that, but you could also watch it on DVD 6 months to 8 months later and go, oh, actually, this is really well written and there's loads of depth there, which I don't think you can do with Transformers Rise of the Beasts.
I don't know, man. Let's give it some time to cook.
Let's give it some time to cook. Yeah, it's going to get better. Yeah, yeah. Let the CGI age.
Yeah, let's just let Michael Bay's masterpiece simmer for a bit. You know what I mean?
Oh, the CGI just needed a nice patina of 20 years of being out of date. And then suddenly we went, oh, wow, this is War and Peace.
Look at Jurassic Park. 1993 still holds up.
Yeah, because most of it's practical. We covered that when we did all the Jurassic Park movies. There's very little CGI in those films. There's like three
shots. Same with Transformers Rise of the Beast. That robot gorilla, totally right. in camera. Right.
I didn't even know that there were gorillas in Transformers. Yeah, I don't know. I've never seen one. For the benefit of the people that haven't seen this film and want a reminder on what happened, so that you kind of have a better idea of what we're talking about going in, or for people who've never seen it and never planned to, I'll echo my co-host's words last week. Grow up. It's a film. What's the worst that's going to happen? Do you want to break down the story? I've got a little jingle. You ready?
Yeah. We're having a breakdown. Maximus Decimus Meridius. Thanks for full naming that one, bud.
Nailed it.
Thank you. A respected Roman general is betrayed by Emperor Commodus, who orders the murder of Maximus's family. I see what you've done here. This is great. Thank you.
Genuinely haven't. I wrote this in a rush. I didn't know who was going first.
Okay. After surviving an assassination attempt, Maximus is captured and sold into slavery, forced to fight as a gladiator. Stripped of his rank and his loved ones, Maximus's drive for revenge begins to take shape as he vows to confront Commodus and avenge the deaths of his wife and son.
That makes it sound really pulpy. It's actually done with quite a lot of sensitivity.
It's a very delicate story.
Yeah,
it's very
the way
gentle.
I've written it, it sounds like a sort of 1950s sci-fi novel.
Yeah, literally.
Maximus's journey takes him to the gladiatorial arena, where he quickly gains fame for his combat skills. As he rises through the ranks, his thirst for vengeance grows, with each victory bringing him closer to his goal. Along the way, Maximus forms bonds with fellow gladiators, and together they face increasingly brutal challenges of the arena.
Yeah.
Despite the violence, Maximus remains focused on his ultimate goal, to confront the Emperor and restore his honor.
Maximus's revenge is complicated as he gets closer to Commodus, who now rules Rome. Maximus participates in a grand gladiatorial event in the Colosseum, where he faces Commodus in a staged fight, but chooses to fight fairly, keeping his moral code intact. Bigger man than I am in that scene, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I'd have curb stomped him immediately. His longing for vengeance intensifies as he realizes that even if he kills Commodus, he won't undo the losses that he has suffered.
In the final moments of the film, Maximus successfully kills Commodus, but is mortally wounded in the process. With his last breath, he ensures that Rome will return to a republic, fulfilling promises made in the start of the movie. Maximus dies peacefully, his quest for revenge complete, but his personal losses remain forever unhealed, his actions restoring justice, but at the price of his life.
I cannot get over how annoyed I am at myself.
Right.
For not watching this film more.
Okay, I'm going to temper that a little bit, because I think I watched it quite young. Mm-hmm. In the cinema, and then my mum was obsessed with it. She bought it on DVD, and part of like the whole way that we would watch films as a family mm-hmm. is that we would eat dinner, watch a movie whilst we were eating dinner, and then once the movie was over, we'd chat for a few hours. So mm-hmm. a lot of my early understanding of movies was based on my family doing what you and I do. We chat about movies, and this is good, and that was good, and here's the subtext there. So I kind of got a cheat code to the subtext stuff.
Right, okay.
Had I watched it just by myself without a family of, readers who were like chatting about the subtext of a movie, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd have just gone, oh, it's a cool action movie, isn't it? I moved on with my life.
Yeah,
and then maybe not watched it for 15, 20 years and then gone, yeah, it's fine.
That's exactly what I've done. Right. That's exactly what I've done. But I've watched it now in 2024.
Having lived a life.
Having lived a life and having gone through some struggles.
Yeah.
And then you watch this story and you're like, oh my God.
Right.
Oh
right.
my God. It's a way more in-depth and nuanced way of saying, there are two wolves inside you. Do you know what I mean? Except for in
and
this
both
story.
Both of them are c***s.
Yeah. But the story's meant because they're both assholes, but except for one's a moral slave murderer and the other one is a murderous slaver.
So
you know what I mean?
One of my early insights to this film that I adore, and the reason I adore it, is the first time you watch it, you look at Joaquin Phoenix playing Commodus, and both the lead performances in this are brilliant. We'll get into that later.
Insane.
We've got a whole thing about it, but
yes, please.
You watch it, and he's so effective at being a villain that you're on Maximus's side, and you're like, yeah, get him. He's the worst. He's literally one of the most villainous turns in cinema. And you'd be right. He is one of the most villainous turns in cinema.
Yeah.
But as you grow older and you watch it again, you realize that Commodus as a character is about 17 or 18.
Right.
he's been raised his entire life in the sure knowledge that his father will respect thousands of years of tradition and make him emperor when his father dies.
Yeah.
All of that surety in what his future was going to be is what makes okay his father's complete disinterest and rampant disrespect in front of genuine slaves.
Yeah.
He will turn to people who are about 15 management layers down and go, look at my son, isn't he a cunt? In front of everyone.
Yeah. Right. Oh, here comes my son, mincing across the battlefield the second that the war's over. Yeah, all right.
Right. Oh, you've lost an arm, is it? Look at that. Look at that disappointment. That's what you've lost it for. Trust me, mate, I'm as heartbroken as you are. Yeah. Anyway, that's all fine because he knows he's just got to grit and bear his teeth and it's going to be he's going to be emperor. Yeah. And then on his deathbed, his dad turns around and goes, now I'm going to give it to that guy that I get on with much, much better.
Yeah, I'm going to give it to Maximus.
I'm going
to
change physics as far as you're concerned just to fuck you over.
Yeah.
And then in a moment of passion, he kills his dad, which, by the way, was not rare at the time.
That's an odd thing to say out loud.
Succession by murder was really, really common in monarchies, dude.
All right, I need to look into this. Maybe history might be my thing because I might be able to cleanse a chip or two off my shoulder on that one, buddy.
So the rest of the film is a child, an unloved child, going, I just want these people to love me.
Yeah, yeah.
And his dad's ex keeps booting the door and going, you're a cunt, though.
Yeah, no, get in the bin. Back in the corner, shoo.
And then the film ends with this unloved child being murdered in front of his people, and not a single one of them goes, ooh, that's a bit unfair.
No one cares. Not one cares. Single. Oh my God. The actual fact of when I was watching it this time around, it brought me to tears for two reasons. One, when Commodus dies, he threw Rome a 150-day gladiator event. It's half a year of games for just fun. And do you know how he paid for it? By selling wheat reserves, not by raising taxes. He was like, no, my people need to enjoy themselves, not stress about money. I'm just going to sell off our literal resources to make sure that everyone is a bit happier. And then, as he's dying, every single person in there is silent. No one, not one care is given.
My favorite scene in the whole film, well, one of my favorite scenes in the whole film is when his father tells him he's not going to be emperor. And he gives this speech. I'm going to read bits of it out. And for those of you with daddy issues, welcome. He says to his dad, you wrote to me once, listing the four chief virtues, wisdom, justice, fortitude, and temperance. And as I read the list, I knew I had none of them. Even then, it was as if you didn't want me for your son. I searched the faces of the gods for ways to please you, to make you proud. One kind word, one full hug, where you pressed me to your chest and held me tight, would have been like the sun on my heart for 1,000 years. What is it in me that you hate so much?
Jesus Christ. Do you know what I mean?
He gets murdered at the end and everyone's like, yay!
Yeah, everyone's fine. He is literally just, he just needs a cuddle from the one person that's been an asshole to him his entire life. And it's heartbreaking. That's the one bit that got me. Yeah. The second bit that got me is you're watching Maximus literally give up everything for a third time in one 3-hour sitting for a Rome that he is never going to see.
Yeah.
He's never going to live in that. He's never going to live in the society. Mm. He's like, but it deserves to be the best it possibly can be.
Yeah.
And it broke me multiple
times. It's not
times.
What I expected from Ridley Scott. Let's put it that way. Like Ridley Scott,
dude,
Alien,
oh
Blade Runner.
Oh my God. Thelma and Louise. Like, what are we talking about here?
G.I. Jane.
This G.I. Jane, right? He's got tons of stuff. Legend. Tons of stuff that is like great scripts, big sci-fis, you know, this, that, and the other. And then out of nowhere, pulls out a fucking sword and sandals gladiator piece.
Yeah, but then he made Aliens, so he's kind of platinum trophied film.
Yeah.
And then he's now just doing like Snoop Dogg side quests.
Dude, I've got a whole bit on why he made this film, right?
Okay.
Thank you for that glorious transition. That was beautiful, by the way.
That's how good they can be.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, I'll try. I'll get a hint. I'll try. So, Ridley Scott gets presented a script.
Right.
And they're like, when he's handed this script, they're like, it's not good.
Right.
You're not going to want to do it. And he was like, right.
I'm sold.
Yeah. Let me just give this a squiz over real quick. And whilst being handed this script and being told, that it isn't very good.
Yeah.
He was also shown a painting.
Okay.
By Jerome. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Yeah, Jerome.
Jerome.
They did Rio.
In the bin. In the bin. I mean, who put 50p in you today? Do you know what I mean? Like, you're full of them. Busted and Duran Duran jokes. Whoa. Jesus Christ.
But yes, painting by Jerome. I've not seen it, but I read somewhere he'd seen a painting.
Funny that you should say that, because I tracked it down, because he's a fucking idiot. Ridley Scott, whilst being shown this script that was told was not very good, was shown a painting by Jerome. This is a direct quote from Ridley.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I love doing period films.
Carrie.
I love the research. I love to create sort of smells of the period.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's an odd turn of phrase, but it's fine.
Right.
Yeah. I think what we did with the first Gladiator, I don't like being critical of other things that have happened before, but I wasn't the biggest fan of Hollywood Roman epics.
Right.
They feel artificial, and so when I was asked to consider a script, the script was not very good. But the person who gave it to me said, I want to show you one thing. Picked up an illustration. Now, this is true. It's called For Those About to Die by Jerome.
Right,
he holds it up. It's a picture of this big painting of the Colosseum. And in the corner, there is this guy about to tuna fork this poor bastard. He's got this thing in his neck and he's looking up for permission to kill. I went, bloody hell. That's never been done before properly. Never. And I said, I'll do it. And the person who gave me the script went, you will? And he was like, yes. And the person said, do you want to read the script? And he said, no.
Oh, God, really?
Ridley Scott said no. And we went off and hit the ground running around the table and evolved the new material. So that's how he signed on for this film. Now, I was like, oh, okay, that's a pretty cool story. I'm gonna try and find the inspiration that inspired Ridley Scott to make Gladiator. So I went out to try and find For Those About to Die. It's not a fucking painting by Jerome.
I was going to say, I've just tried to Google it.
Yeah, it's not one.
Nothing came up while you were chatting.
It's not one, mate. So what it is,
it's
called
an Usborne book.
It's called Hail Caesar.
Right.
For those of us who are about to die, we salute you.
Right, okay.
And it's the wrong painting.
Oh, for God's sakes.
He's not on about this painting, because I've got For Those of Us Who Are About to Die, We Salute You in front of me. And it's a well-dressed gentleman and stood in front of 7 or 8 gladiators. And he's sort of peering up at the emperor as if to be sort of like, get me the fuck out of here, whilst the Colosseum is being cleaned up, right? It's a great photo. It's a great painting. Great picture.
But it's not
the one. It's not the one. The one that Ridley Scott is talking about is... Because I've had to go through Wiki Art
of
these drone things to try and find this image. Welcome to Hyper Focus Corner.
Oh, God.
It's called Police Verso. And it is by Jerome, wildly different painting.
Right.
Because in this one, he's not looking up at the emperor for permission to kill. He's looking up at the Vestal Virgins. And it's also controversial because the Vestal Virgins are putting their thumb down. And it caused this big outrage in the 1800s, being sort of like, Romans didn't use thumbs down as a negative. And then there was a huge debate for years about whether a thumb up or a thumb down was used in ancient Rome. Anyway, Ridley Scott's just done this big inspirational thing in an interview for Gladiator 2, being like, yeah, in the first one, this is what really got me. And just name dropped everything could be wrong.
It feeds my opinion of Ridley Scott.
Okay.
Because Ridley Scott, for me, you remember when we first started Nolan and you were like, he's just a posh boy making posh boy films.
Yeah.
For me, Ridley Scott, he gets Alien, which, let's face it, is only a third his film. The writing... Sure.
Yeah.
And the art direction and all the people in that film that made that brilliant. It's not necessarily the directorial touch that makes Alien brilliant. It's a million things, of which that's one.
Yes.
Same with Blade Runner, right?
Yeah, of course.
Incredible looking films. And a lot of it isn't where the cameras decided to be put. It's the sets.
Yes.
It's the script. It's the world building, right?
Yes. So
he's this kind of privately educated dude who just jobs about. He's a massive history nerd.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people ask him questions and he doesn't have an answer, but he's terrified, like I used to be not very long ago, which happens. I went to a grammar school, which isn't private school, but it's that thing of someone asks you a thing and you just go, I've got to sound like I know what I'm talking about because I'm the director and I'm promo in the film, and just chats. just goes bleh.
Yeah.
Evidenced by, whilst I was looking into Ridley Scott, Ridley Scott stated in an interview with Wired magazine,
right,
the best science fiction films ever made, in his opinion,
right,
are 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Okay, I can see that.
Star Wars, A New Hope.
Okay, that's fine, yeah.
On the Beach, which I've not seen.
Not seen it.
Next two I have, Alien.
Blade Runner.
I
love this guy. I love this guy so much. And I'm going to tell you what, when I've been looking into Ridley Scott, don't take this offensively after everything that you've just said.
Uh-huh.
He reminds me of you.
Oh, okay.
No, in the best possible way, in the best possible way. This is me being a sincere.
Right.
He reminds me of you, and I'm going to get into why shortly.
Okay.
He reminds me of you for two reasons, right? The way that he treated Russell Crowe and the way that he treated Joaquin Phoenix.
Right.
Love it.
Brilliant performances by them in this film.
Insane.
And again, it feels like a lot of this film, that a lot of what makes this film brilliant,
mm-hmm,
isn't Ridley Scott. Russell Crowe and Joaquin Phoenix, if you swap them out for
anyone,
Sean Penn and Timothy Chalamet, this film doesn't work.
No, of course not. Like, of course not. It's an awful film. But you've mentioned about the scripts. Now, I've got a little tidbit about the script of this film and how it came to be. We just mentioned that the script was terrible. Ridley Scott didn't like it. Russell Crowe read it and was like, this is stupid. He literally read it and was like, this is nonsense. I don't think I'm going to do this film.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason he signed on is because of the chats that he had with Ridley Scott. Now, I've got something from Russell Crowe here. I'm just going to read this out verbatim.
Right. Can you do it in Russell Crowe's accent?
He's Australian, right?
Famously.
Then no, I'm not. I did it before and I had messages, so I'm not. I was confident about my abilities as a leading man. What I wasn't confident about with Gladiator was the world that was surrounding me. At the core of what we were doing was a great concept, but the script was rubbish, absolute rubbish. And it had all sorts of strange sequences. Gladiators would have like endorsements on their chariots for olive oil, like adverts.
Historically accurate, but why would you put that in a film?
This is exactly what Russell Crowe said. Russell Crowe said, that's all true, but it's just not going to ring right with a modern audience. They're going to go, what the fuck is all this?
Right.
The energy around where we were and what we were doing was very fractured. I did think a couple of times, maybe my best option is to just get on a plane and fuck off. It was my continued conversations with Ridley that sort of gave me faith. And this is where he reminded me of you a little bit, because if I'm ever having a wobble, or if I'm ever like uncomfortable with change and I don't know which direction we're going in and all of this stuff, this is what Ridley did for Russell. He said to me at one point in time, mate, we're not committing anything to camera that you don't believe in 100%. Which is a lovely thing.
It's also a lie.
It was 1,000% a lie. But anyway. So when we actually started the film, we'd stripped the script back to 21 pages that we had agreed on. Now, a script is usually between 103 and 110 pages. So we had a long way to go. And basically used up all 21 pages of the script that we had in the first section of the movie. So by the time we got to our second location, which was Morocco, we were playing catch up. Yeah. So Ridley Scott here has got Russell Crowe, who's on his back legs being like, I know what I'm doing. I just don't know what you're doing. I don't know what the crew's doing. I don't know what this film's doing. I don't know where we are or what we're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ridley sat him down and gone, look, I hear what you're saying. The script's shit. But how about me and you, we really get into this, yeah?
Right.
And we get into it. You help me write it. I help you write it. We get these things going on. We do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
There's like a little behind the scenes documentary that I've been watching. It's six parts. Each part's like an hour long and it goes like really in depth. It's amazing.
God bless DVD extras.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the scene where Russell Crowe is traveling back from Germania. So he's going back from like the German borders.
To Spain.
He goes back to Spain.
On two horses. Right?
Yeah, he rides a horse to death. Yeah. And he's like battered beyond belief. And when he gets there, his wife and child have been burned and nailed to a crucifix.
Oh, it's such an affecting scene.
It's horrible.
And he nails it.
He nails it
to the wall. He's got snot on command.
Dude, this is where I'm going with this. Ridley and him had this big thing about the snot and the amount of snot that Russell Crowe could produce. It was The way that this is described in this interview is harrowing, because I was watching it and I was like, this is a car crash. You can't be sitting there as Russell Crowe in a, like a tuxedo. He's all like, yeah, so then as I was walking up towards the house, I started doing a bit of snot, but it was a bit too much. And then I had like a spider's web of snot between my hands and then more hands. And it was like just webbing everywhere. And then right. I was like, Ridley, I'm going to go and kiss my wife's foot. And he was like, no, don't do that. No, don't do that, because I've set up lighting 20 feet away. So don't go and kiss the wife's foot. And he's like, nah, I'm going to do it, mate. I've got to go kiss her foot, because I failed my wife once. And it, I've gone northern. I failed my wife once. And if I do it, I've come all this way and I don't like say goodbye to her, I failed her again.
He's correct.
He is correct.
He's correct.
And do you know what Ridley said?
Right.
No. And then Russell Crowe did it anyway and was like, yeah, that's a great idea, that is, mate. That's a great idea.
Right. This is why Ridley annoys me.
I love him.
There's a quote from Russell Crowe that I love. It comes from the making of this film.
Amazing.
And it's only, I've had to Google it just now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where he was talking about some of the lines where he sat with Commodus, and some of the lines when they're in the arena and he goes, my name is Maximus Decimus Viridius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife.
Yes.
And it's mint, and the Hans Zimmer score is going.
Dude, it's amazing.
Russell Crowe didn't like bits of that script, so he had to get them changed.
Yeah.
And there's bits in there that he still, to this day, thinks are corny as all hell. Okay. But it doesn't matter, because it just, he carries it.
Yeah.
But his quote was, to the writer, your lines are garbage, but luckily, I'm the greatest actor in the world, and I can even make garbage sound good. And the thing is, if you read that line sincerely,
yeah,
he's a yeah. But if you read it with the heavy note of self-aware sarcasm that it was no doubt delivered with, he's f***ing hilarious. Mm.
It's that Australian humour,
right,
that no one else in the world can get away with.
Just dry irony, but it's also confident as all hell.
You can't say an American accent because you're immediately ostracized. Right. Say an Australian accent, everyone's like, hey!
Speaking of Russell Crowe, I know he's a divisive actor. There are lots of people who say he's got an angry face, mm-hmm. or they don't like him. I got a list of his injuries that he sustained on this film. It's insane.
Amazing.
He dislocated his hip.
His hip?
He tore his Achilles tendon.
Oh my God.
He's got grade 4 tears in both Achilles tendons.
Jesus.
He broke his foot. He popped a bicep tendon out of its socket.
That's disgusting.
And broke his face and broke his shoulder.
Outstanding. Right. Everything that you just said is awful. And there was no trigger warning there. I gipped when you said dislocated hip.
Right.
Because that sounds... That's pelvic damage. That's the worst thing I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sit. You can't lie down. How do you get comfortable? You don't.
Right.
I've done some background on Russell Crowe as well. You've got his list of injuries here. He might be my favorite person that's ever existed. So, tigers. Are they good co-stars? Right. Are they good co-stars? This is the question that we need to think about.
I imagine not. Right. Because they always say never work with kids or animals, right?
Right. Yeah.
And like, I tried filming a cat once.
Yeah.
And it could not give a fuck about direction.
Okay. So now picture that with tigers.
Yeah.
On chains that is being manhandled by two human adults, right? That's who is in control of a tiger on a chain. Okay. Yeah. Rob, let me ask you a quick question. Have you ever think about building a big old Colosseum set, you know, for you and the hordes of extras that you're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to, the leading actors that are earning millions to work in, you know, and then letting...
I don't have that kind of budget in my sex life.
Okay,
no.
Yeah, fair. And then have you ever thought about, I don't know, maybe letting four tigers on retractable chains out to really sell the scene?
Again, don't have that budget for my sex life.
All right. Well, you ever think about how small that set gets and how fast it shrinks when you have four Bengal tigers on chains actively chasing your lead actors in this massive set? The set is tiny, buddy. It is minuscule now. You have like a 4-foot radius around the edge of the Colosseum that is not the tiger kill zone, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So I hadn't considered this at all right up until Ridley Scott said in this behind the scenes documentary, they're so quick. And that's what you got to be aware of.
They're tigers, Ridley.
Yeah, they're tigers. Melt. They're literally 11 feet long and nothing but muscle. Right? You got to stay aware, because if they get a hold of you, you're dead before the animal handler gets there. Yes, obviously.
They're tigers, Ridley.
Because it's a tiger and you're being mauled. That man is not going to step in the middle of that and go, boys, settle down here. This is a film that we're making. Let's think of the careers. Let's think of the job. There's a release date in 6 months. Tigers, no.
Although if there's one human on the planet capable of punching out a tiger, I would put my money on Russell Crowe.
Dude, this is where the Russell Crowe tidbit comes in.
Right.
Because the documentary hard cuts to Russell Crowe close up just going, I was just drawn to these creatures. And it's like, buddy, stay away from the fucking tigers. There was a little running joke with the cast on this film on how many times Russell Crowe had to dive out of the way of a tiger attack. And the saying that he said was, I mean, that was a bit close. And it's like, yes, buddy, because you're stood entirely too close to the tiger to do an off-camera quip pretending to be Steve Irwin. Let's not do that because you might die. I love him so much. He's incredible.
I want to talk about the other main actor. But before we do, can mm-hmm. we just do our little mid-roll advert reel?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get into it.
Talk about the sponsor of this week's episode.
Yeah, buddy.
And this week we are sponsored by the Every Movie Ever podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Every Movie Ever podcast. My name is Ben Groves.
And I'm Rod McFarlane. We're two 35-year-old best mates diving deep into movies and mental health, talking around...
Never about
our problems.
We tackle the latest cinema releases to all-time classics, horror gems, to indie drama llamas, and Fight Club's deep transsexuality, all while holding our sanity together. Barely holding our sanity together.
Expect deep dives, brutal honesty, and a ton of fascinating film facts. Plus, no one has yet to prove our show isn't Jesus.
Every Movie Ever podcast, movie facts, mental health, might be Jesus. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to the Every Movie Ever podcast for sponsoring our show.
Yeah. Should we get back to the film?
Yeah, let's do that one.
Because those boys sound like...
Oh, don't listen.
Great actors on this film, right?
Yes, buddy.
There's one that I really want to... Well, there's a couple I want to talk about. Joaquin Phoenix is brilliant, and I think this is his first. This is the first time I saw how brilliant he could be, and
yeah,
it's a level of brilliance he doesn't actually achieve all that regularly nowadays.
I beg to differ.
He's very, very good in a lot of his recent stuff. I don't know if he's as good as he is in this.
Okay, I have different thoughts.
Or I don't know whether or not I'm just expecting it. Maybe I'm expecting it from him, so I'm like,
yeah.
I'm waiting for the magic trick.
Yeah, you know?
And there's the card. All right,
magic
boy.
Always close-up magic. It's always close-up magic with you. It's insane. It's insane.
It's a good analogy. It's a good analogy. The other guy I want to mention is really important. Is Oliver Reed.
Speaking of performances that are blisteringly good, you remember earlier when I said Ridley Scott reminds me of you a little bit?
Right.
The last nail in the coffin for me that was like, you know what? Ridley Scott might be a dude. He might be a dude.
Right.
He tricked Joaquin Phoenix.
What?
Into his amazing performance. So, but obviously this is like Joaquin's first major production, right?
He's done bits and bobs, but not much.
He's been a child actor. For his entire childhood. Like, he's been doing stuff all over the place as Leaf Phoenix.
Oh, of course, yeah. Leaf.
Yeah. He's been doing bits all over the place. And obviously Ridley cast him and was like, yep, you are Commodus.
Yep.
You are going to do this and you are going to be incredible. Joaquin freaked out. He was wigging out.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
I've got a big chunk of stuff from Joaquin who goes into how Ridley tricked him.
Is it true he fainted at one point?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Tell me about that.
So he was down to nerves,
right.
Unable to do anything, physically, visibly shaking,
mm-hmm.
passes out because of the stress of everything that is going on around him. He's just unable to get takes done, unable to get anything out. It's just, you know what I mean? It's one of these things where it's built it up in his head so much
that it
is now a crippling...
Got performance anxiety, literally.
Literal crippling anxiety monster that stood in front of him.
Yeah.
It's his first big break. So... I've got this little bit from Joaquin Phoenix here. You ready?
Yeah.
I was so green. I had obviously been acting since I was a kid, but I'd never mm-hmm. been part of a major production. And when I arrived on set for Gladiator, honestly, I was so sick. I was shaking. I couldn't believe the size of the location, just how mm-hmm. many trucks there were. And I was terrified. Like really, mm-hmm. truly terrified. I couldn't do the first scene. I was literally, visibly shaking, and I couldn't get through the dialogue. Oof. My voice was quivering, and Ridley Scott kept rolling, and it was just take after take after take. And I can't remember how many takes exactly. We did just take after take for hours on end.
Right.
And at the end of the film, after everything was done and dusted, the film had wrapped, Ridley turned to Joaquin and said, "You do know that I didn't have any film on the camera until like the last five takes, right?" And
savage.
Because Ridley knew that it wouldn't be beneficial to Joaquin,
right,
for him to just say, "Let's just rehearse it. Let's just see how we get on."
Yeah.
He had to make Joaquin feel as if they were actively filming, and he was asking the crew and the rest of the cast to keep up the act and keep doing the same shot over and over and over, because he knew it was the only way for me to get to a place of feeling comfortable. And I was just so amazed by that. And if that, buddy...
Is that from Ridley Scott or is that from Joaquin Phoenix?
That's from Joaquin Phoenix. So Joaquin Phoenix spoke about how Ridley Scott literally got the entire cast and crew to commit to doing hours of takes with no film on the cameras to make sure that Joaquin got the performance that he did. That's mind-blowing to me, and that is 1,000% something that you would do for someone that you cared about.
Here's the thing. It's something I used to do all the time, but it's the reverse, and I swear it's bullshit that what Ridley's saying. What I used to do with artists in the studio, right, is you tell them you're not recording and you record it because you always record everything.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
The idea that you get Joaquin Phoenix, you get everyone set, everything's ready, and you tell him you're filming but don't.
Yeah.
My question is, what happens when you then watch with your eyes an incredible, unrepeatable performance, and Joaquin turns around and goes, "Oh my God, I cracked it. I really got it there. I don't know how I did it, but that's the one.
Yep.
Can I see it back?" What do you say to him then?
No, it's you on tape. Do that.
Right. What you do instead is you film all of them.
Right.
You waste a mile of film.
Right.
And then when he's feeling like shit at the end of it, you tell him you only recorded the last five, so he feels better about having done 50.
Okay, I see where you're coming from.
It's a nice thing to tell an actor who's feeling a little bit like they shit the bed to go, no, don't worry, buddy.
Right.
I only had it rolling for the last five. There's no way on God's earth I would ever let anyone do their thing and then me not catch it, because that's literally my job.
Right, so your thing is audio, and I understand that with audio, unless you're recording to tape, which is wildly expensive, you can afford the disc space to let it record for 2 hours.
I get
hours,
it, it's
you know
different,
I mean?
And I trust Ridley Scott. I know what you're saying is true.
Yeah.
It's just an insane difference in the way I used to work.
It is an insane difference.
Because I would, as with many times, go in and go, just go in and rehearse it, and then I'd lean over and just hit record.
Yeah, you've done it to me countless times. It's infuriating.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many times the final vocal includes a couple of lines from those rehearsals, though.
It's ridiculous. You've done it to me loads. I love you for it, but also, f*** you. It's the fact that Ridley put himself and the entire production a little bit out of their way to make sure that Joaquin did what he knew Joaquin could do. Even when he stood there shaking, quivering, can't get his dialogue out, can't focus, can't get anything done because of the anxiety. And Ridley's like, "Yeah, let's just go again, man. Keep it rolling. Yeah, let's just go, man. Just keep it rolling."
Good man.
How lovely is that to have an entire crew just have your back for hours on end?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. I get it. It's also their job.
And it's their job. Also, it reminded me of you when I was a little bit like, you know what? Ridley Scott might be a dude. And not just someone who can never pick scripts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's such a bad curator.
Yeah, he's awful.
He really is.
Right, there's tons of stuff that I've done that we can't get into because time. CGI of this film's insane. There's some facts in here where it is literally, they had 2,000 extras.
Right.
And they CGI'd for the Colosseum crowd, they CGI'd up to 70,000 people. All of them, all of them milling about, all of them cheering and jeering.
The spectacle of this film is, there's no point in us waxing lyrical about it. You've got to watch it and pretend it's the year 2000.
Yeah.
And the Matrix has only just come out and you're like, yeah, it's all about the future. And then you watch this and you're like, no, it's all about the past.
Yeah.
like, we could have done a 3-hour show about the mechanical making of it.
Oh yeah, 1,000%.
But realistically, just go watch the film.
Dude, like, there is documentaries on the miniatures that were built for this film that are longer than the film.
Right.
Director's cut.
Right.
I'm being serious. I've watched one and I got to the end of it and was like, wow. So essentially, they built a miniature, put a bit of CGI in it. Awesome. It's an incredible watch, but also if we're going to sit here and talk about it, we'd get a textbook. Do you know what I mean? Get a notebook.
100%.
We're taking notes, bud.
The thing that I find most interesting and most relevant about this film, watching it this week, especially with how I feel today, which is super panicked and super like, the world has changed forever and it's everything is worse now.
It might be. It might not be.
Is, there's an interview with Ridley Scott and he specifies that the hidden dagger that Commodus pulls out of his sleeve during the final duel is the same one that he uses to stab Maximus in the back of the lung before the fight.
Ooh.
So they're both killed by the same weapon.
Yeah. Right?
So they're both killed the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it kind of sets up the two main characters of this film, because you can see Commodus as an antagonist, and he is.
Yeah.
But he's also got a point. But Commodus is an external validation seeking, victim complex kind of grief denier.
Okay.
While Maximus is totally internally validated.
Yeah.
Very self-aware, grief acceptor.
Yes.
And they both die by the same weapon.
Yes.
But both men lost the future that they were certain was going to happen.
They did.
Commodus was certain he was going to be emperor. Maximus was certain he was going to retire and spend his retirement with his wife and kids. And that changed.
It did.
Right. Life came along and went, no, fuck yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The differences in their story in this film all depend on how they react to that.
It does.
Maximus accepts his grief. He mourns his family. Mm-hmm. He talks about his family with his mates. He recognizes that things are really bad right now, but they're not going to be bad forever because he'll see his family again in the afterlife. He's got that acceptance of his loss.
Yeah.
He accepts his loss. Commodus denies his loss. He fights against it.
Yeah.
No, I won't accept that loss. I won't take that loss on the chin. I won't take it as a learning moment. I will say, nah, I'm going to steal it back.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not right. That's illegal. That's cheating. Maximus has an inherent sense of confidence, whereas Commodus only values himself by how other people value him.
Whoa.
Looks to the people of Rome, why don't you love me? Looks to his dad, why, what's wrong with me? How can you not see how brilliant I am?
Yeah, yeah.
Maximus accepts his limitations and his vulnerabilities. There's a scene where he's chatting with Lucilla, Connie Nielsen's character, and he's like, what do you expect me to do about this? I am a slave.
Yeah.
I'm not in a position where I can influence this. This isn't something I have any control over. So I don't feel any guilt about what's going on, and I don't feel like this. It's not like on the back of your sobriety coin. Grant me the serenity to understand what I can change, what I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And he's like, I can't. Whereas Commodus is going around going, I'm the emperor of Rome, and it has to happen my way. It's my way or the highway. I have the power. I have the control.
The way that they're both portrayed,
both
of them are relatable. Like, obviously, one's a slave, and one's an detestable emperor of Rome.
Yeah,
but they're
one of them's quite likeable and quite friendly and quite honourable, and the other one's a detestable little worm. But like,
both relatable, and they're both portrayed relatable that way. They're both portrayed with their own struggles. And the director's cut that we both watched, there's tons of extra little tidbits that really pepper the character development, so that you see the struggles that they're having.
Yeah,
when their mask slips a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
This director's cut is a brilliant director's cut for people who've seen the theatrical.
Yes.
Watch the theatrical, and if you enjoy it, next time you watch the film a few years later, watch the director's cut, and you'll go, oh, wow, I appreciated that.
Well, my theatrical cut only showed up in the last couple of days. I watched the director's cut twice, and I didn't know where else to get the theatrical cut from, so I ordered the VHS, and it showed up, like, yesterday. I haven't had time to watch it yet.
Yeah.
But I will do.
Right.
And it'll be great.
I think just briefly, and I'll wrap up that point, that terrible things happen to both these men and the future that they were certain of is taken away from them. Mm-hmm. And the only difference between their stories is that one of them accepts that loss and recognizes that they will, the good days will happen again,
yeah,
but not yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are active and they're kind. And kindness is a really, really powerful strength when you've got tough times like Maximus.
It really, truly is.
And it's what will get him and all of us through when inevitably life comes along and goes, no, that thing you were getting, nah, you're not.
Mm-hmm. And if that isn't a poignant lesson for what's happening right now,
right, exactly.
Everywhere, just right. Being a little bit kinder might help
right.
Everyone just get through the struggles, right?
And that's why, for me, this is the perfect blockbuster popcorn template, because it was the first blockbuster I saw, mm-hmm. and it went, here is a woman getting cut in half by a sword,
yep.
nailed onto a wheel, and here is a man fighting tigers,
mm-hmm.
but also there's this that's there if you care for it.
Okay.
But we're going to bury it so you don't have to look at it.
Yeah.
It's only there if you go looking for it.
I love that. See, my first blockbuster was Jaws, and it was Big Shark, head politicians. Also, massive subtext if you want to dive into this one, buddy.
Yeah.
So that was a good one. I love that these were our two blockbusters. We're going to have to do Jaws at some point man.
We really are.
We'll dig into that one.
How much did this make at the cinema?
So it had a budget of 103. How much do you think it made? Give me.
I know this was huge. I know this was huge because this started a spree of like historical action drama movies, like Troy,
300,
Kingdom of Heaven, 300.
300.
Like you couldn't move for him.
No.
And the only way that would have happened
mm-hmm.
is if this was incredibly profitable.
Yeah, massive.
So I'm going to say 300 million.
Way more. It made 465.4 million
damn!
Worldwide.
Yeah. God damn.
I know. And it only took 24 years to get a sequel. Okay, buddy.
Oh, God.
Someone's still recovering from Covenant.
Speaking of awful sequels, would you like to play a game?
I would love to, buddy. What are we doing?
We've done a couple of perhaps ill-advised sequels this year.
Yeah.
Alien Romulus.
Oh, let's not.
The Crow reboot, remake, sequel.
Sure.
Joker 2.
Great film.
How dare you?
I'll die on this hill.
So here's my point.
Mm-hmm.
What if we did that with a band?
Okay.
Would you be interested in starting with me,
mm-hmm.
The Beatles 2?
Yes, buddy.
Right.
Okay, how's this work?
I'm thinking we could have slightly different song titles so we wouldn't get sued.
Right.
So like Helena Digby.
Right, okay.
Or
All You Need Is a Significant Pay Rise in Therapy.
Yeah, buddy.
Tomorrow, all my troubles are so far away.
Instead of Help, I was thinking you could have I Told You I'm Fine Already.
Oh, that's a good one. Told You I'm Fine Already. Don't need nobody.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, what about instead of Let It Be, Fuck It Off?
Fuck it off. Just fuck it off.
Fuck it
brilliant.
Off. Yeah.
Fuck it off.
All right.
Slightly deep album cut, but yeah. He is coming out.
Wow.
Rather than She's Leaving Home.
Okay. That's a good one. What about this one?
We all live in a purple aeroplane. A purple aeroplane.
Waterboarded myself, you absolute bastard.
Oh. What about the already slightly problematic song that Ringo sings called Don't You Know I Mean Boys? And we just call it Girls. And now it's a slightly more problematic song that Ringo sings.
Okay. I had one for this. And this okay. I'm going to be honest. This is why mm-hmm. I brought the whole game.
Okay.
White guy screaming in the mid-afternoon.
Wow. Yeah.
You've got no wings. You'll need a big balloon.
All right.
White guy screaming in the mid-afternoon.
Yeah, I've got that.
That's my final play.
All right. I've got one final one. I think we can close the show on this one. You ready?
Right.
There goes the moon. Ba, 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 ba.
That's Moon Crash by...
Yeah. I love this game. Dude, this game is endless. Like, legitimately.
There goes the moon. It's just Moon Crash.
Are you on about Moonfall, the movie?
Moonfall, sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, Moon Crash might be better, though.
Why didn't they use that as the theme song?
Yeah.
What are you rating Gladiator 2000, Ridley Scott? Because it's sword and sandal.
When I first watched it, it would have been like a 6, because I was like, yes, fine.
It's a fine action.
It's
yeah.
3 hours of my life that I'm going to go, yeah, that's, you know, dusty. That's pretty uh-huh. good. Love sand.
Yeah.
Snotty Russell Crowe kissing a foot. Can't get that image out of my brain. but then obviously like watching it again, really paying mm-hmm. attention to it, genuinely being able to relate to the two characters that are warring at each other and knowing that I've been in both of their shoes at some point.
I've been both these people. What, you tried to fuck your sister? That's gross, Ben.
Nah. 10. Oh, I wish we could do this, but like play it straighter faced. You know what I mean? Because that would be devastating to my reputation. Fat 10 has to be fat 10.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Unbelievable.
You can tell me all the things that are wrong with it. Mm. You can tell me all the reasons that you don't enjoy it. And I'll agree with you.
Yeah.
I will agree with you.
Yeah, of course.
And I'll still give it a 10. It's involuntary. I'm just like, that's nice.
Yeah.
But I really like it.
Oh, you can see the bit that flipped the chariot and this bit. It looks like a hydraulics. Yeah. Yeah, yeah you can.
Brilliant.
Do you know what else you can see?
Still love it.
Fucking tigers, mate. 4 of them. 4 real tigers running about after Russell Crowe. Yeah. Oh, what? But you concerned about a chariot? Fine.
Just one comment corner.
Okay.
This week.
Yeah.
And it's because Christina Delicade.
Okay.
Oh, no. It's because Christina Della Cadena. Cadena? Christina.
Christina! There she is.
She wrote in 8 days ago, and we recorded and we said we would definitely do it this week.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy we've got time this week.
Excellent.
Lovely. You ready?
Yeah, hit me with it.
Hi, Ben and Rob. Christina here. I just listened to your latest episode, and I wanted to send a few words to you two. So this is in response to our... We need to talk episode about launching the Patreon.
Okay.
She says, 2 years ago, I took the chance to accept a new job that implied moving to another country with my 14-year-old son.
Wow.
I'm originally from a Spanish-speaking country and moved to the US, which adds a little complexity to the situation.
Okay.
It's a big change, mostly because I didn't know anybody, and it's still a little hard to have my friends and family so far away. Loneliness can be a really hard thing to deal with. And here is where you two, with your podcast, came into my life. I don't even remember how in the world I ended up finding you, but I'm so glad that I did.
Aww.
As I've heard so many other people say, it feels like I have a date with friends every week, and I look forward to my Monday mornings to start my week listening to you talk, be silly and sarcastic, and share that dark humor I enjoy so much. Isn't that the way true friends talk? This week's episode, about the struggles we were having, had me in tears. You both are so lucky to have each other, and more lucky to know and appreciate that. I never thought I was going to join Patreon, but you made it happen.
Oh.
I'll follow you guys there. I'm happy you found a solution that makes you happy, but also allow us, your friends from way back, to keep having the real content, the one not so stressed about what is trendy or that will attract the masses. I just want to hear how you are doing while also talking about some movie that I may or may not know. Anyway, I was a little worried about what news you were going to share. Last week sounded like you two were tired of the podcast, so again, I'm happy there is a way you can still enjoy it. And by the way, if you ask me, I think you're doing a wonderful job. No need to stress about it.
Well, first off, Christina, love you. Thanks for that. That's incredible. That's incredibly sweet. I cannot imagine how hard it must be to uproot your entire life to a country that's not speaking your native tongue and then you like commit to that long term, because that's insane. I did Japan for 2 years and it was rough.
You ended up working as a friend escort.
Yeah, watered down hooker. I was legit. I was just a renter friend. You know what I mean? God, that's so weird to say out loud, man. I was 18.
Yeah, you were 18, working for alcohol.
Yeah,
in a friend for hire bar.
Yeah, I was getting paid £250 a month.
Oh, Ben, I used to make twice that in a day, mate.
Yeah.
Oh, you were 18, though. I wasn't 18.
Yeah, yeah, Ben. Dude. Same here.
And also, we're both in the same spot. We're both in our mum's f***ing basements now, aren't we?
That's what I mean. Christina, that's honestly, it's lovely. Sorry to worry you about the where we were going with it. It was more just
I'm not.
A...
I intended to. It was a manipulation ploy.
All right, Ridley, calm down. No, Jesus Christ, everyone's wacky into you, aren't they?
No, we are genuinely so grateful to have our audience. And since we've started Patreon, I'm just going to jinx it right now and say that things have been much, much easier. That, sadly, is all the time we have for this week.
It is. And I am gutted because I've been having a whale of a time, mate. This is exactly what I needed.
Recording's so much better now, isn't it?
Yeah, dude, honestly. So much fun. Guys, thank you so much for hanging out with us. You have no idea how much this means to us both. We love you from the bottom of our hearts. Thank you for spending time with us. We'll see you next week. What are we doing next week?
Next week, mate, we are doing Benjamin Button.
Yay! Let's hope it ages as well as Brad Pitt does in that film.
Oh, and that's why we get paid the small bucks.
That's why we get paid pennies, buddy.
Ben is now going to thank you for spending an hour of your week with us, especially at the start of your week. We know a lot of you listen on a Monday.
Yeah.
By wrapping up the thoughts, themes, and feelings of this movie into a little, you know, Monday motivational pep talk to help you get through your week.
Mm.
It's going to be a difficult week for us all, and Ben is going to make it all better while I just tell you to do what society has always told you to do and probably always will tell you to do. Consume.
Do I go like wisdom-y or do I go edgelordy? We'll go wisdom-y. So the movie, obviously, you've got the two ways that you can handle any sort of grief. Your life changes, is out of your control. You have two ways to handle it. Your Commodus or your Maximus. I would always recommend choosing Maximus, but just know that if you do happen to be on Commodus's path, there is always a way out. You know what I mean? There's always a Maximus there to stab you in the fucking throat in front of a crowd of people that do not give a shit about your existence. Joke's on you. It was the Edgelord path all along. There are two wolves inside you, buddy. One of them is mean and the other one is a Sigma.
And they're both kids.